started, I'm going to give you the same announcement that you get at the music center, which is please turn off all your cell phones, your pagers, your iPhones, and so forth, and then we'll get started. I guess we'll begin. First of all, I want to welcome you to USC this afternoon and introduce myself. I'm Sandy Sawchuk, and I'm the systems chair of the Mingxia Department of Electrical Engineering here. And we want to welcome you to our Viterbi lecture. This is the annual keynote lecture for our department, and it has several functions. First of all, it's a tribute to Andrew and Erna Viterbi, and the commemoration of the technical achievements of our faculty, particularly in information theory and in communications. As you may know, these fields have a very strong heritage at USC. We have 4 Shannon Award winners among our faculty, and a very strong heritage going back for many years in these particular fields. Before we get started, I want to introduce a few of our special guests who are here with us today, most particularly, our USC EE alumnus and trustee Andrew Viterbi and his wife Erna. And I also want to mention USC EE alumnus and trustee Ming Xia. Unfortunately, he couldn't be with us, but as you probably know, he supplied the naming gift for our department in the fall of 2006. I also want to introduce our provost and our Mingxia EE faculty member, Max Nikias. And then our Viterbi School Dean, Yanis Yortsos. And then our electrophysics chair in the Mingxia department, Dan Dacus. And we have one other special guest. We have last year's Viterbi lecturer. You may all recall the talk that we had about a year ago by Bob McLeese of Caltech. Bob's with us here today. So I'm going to move on and just mention initially our honoree and our speaker tonight, Professor Jack Wolf from the University of California, San Diego. Jack is here, of course. And I also want to introduce his wife, Toby, who's in the back. And Jack is the Stephen O. Rice Professor of Electrical and Computer Engineering at UC San Diego. And he's also a member of the Center for Magnetic Recording Research at UCSD. A little bit about his academic background. He received a BSED from University of Pennsylvania and the MS and PhD degrees from Princeton University. He's received many honors and awards. He's a member of the National Academy of Engineering, member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and has received a number of very important IEEE awards, including the Claude Shannon Award in 2001, the Richard Hamming Medal in 2004, and the Aaron Weiner Distinguished Service Medal in 2007. I'm going to now defer to Andrew Viterbi, who has a few extra words of introduction, and then we'll get started.
Well, thank you very much, Sandy. I appreciate a chance to say a couple of words. I really just want to say how thrilled I am with this whole lecture, annual lecture event, first and foremost because of the quality of the speakers and the quality of the audience. And secondly, I also have to admit that whereas my name is plastered all over the school for a variety of reasons, this one was a gift, an honor that was bestowed on me by Max Nikias, before I did any of this. So it's doubly appreciated. And then one more comment about the speaker. Other speakers have used my name in vain. They usually let me know what it was. They gave me a feeling. For example, Bob McLeese had me do a cameo bit in his film, things of that nature. Jack told me nothing. So I want to tell you that Jack and I have been friends for over 40 years. Whatever he tells you that is favorable about me, don't believe it. But if he says anything unfavorable, then take it seriously.
Thank you. And now for a little bit of a technical introduction. As you may know, Jack is very well known for his work in information theory and coding, and more recently in signal processing for data storage systems, both in one dimension, two dimensions, and even more. I want to say these are topics of particular personal interest for me, because in the last few years, my students and I have worked on something similar, in particular for three-dimensional data storage in optical systems. So I think we're in for a very interesting talk. As you can see, we have a whole array of props out here. One of the props is something I brought along, which I wanted to use to start off the talk. This thing here is a hard drive. This is a standard 3.5-inch hard drive. And if you were to take out the guts of your desktop PC, you'd find one of these inside. To me, the most astonishing thing is that 20 years ago, when I bought a PC, this hard drive had an astonishing 10 megabytes of storage. Just incredible. Now I can go down to Fry's and buy this hard drive in exactly the same size package, and it has a terabyte. It's 10 to the 7th versus 10 to the 12th bytes in the same package. And so you ask the question, how did they do it? Well, Jack is going to tell us how. And without any delay, Jack, your talk, From Edison to the Truth.
Sandy, for a very, very generous introduction. Andy's introduction, it's true, we've been friends and colleagues and co-workers for a long time. I hope we remain friends after my talk. with that, I'm really honored to be here. I think this is a superb event. I don't think I've ever talked to a group this big at a university. This is an amazing turnout. And I will take it as a compliment, but I think it's really a compliment to Dr. Viterbi. And hopefully the talk really is in his honor. So with that, let me just set things up a little bit. Okay. There's a number of props, and the props are all mine. It started with the device in the center, which is the one with the bighorn, which belonged to my father, and I don't know how far back it went in the family, but it's possible they bought it new. And so in any event, all of these things, well, the Edison phonographs are roughly 100 years old. So. The beginning of the talk is going to be about Edison, and then at the end, you'll see how it ties together with Dr. Viterbi's work. So, a little bit of the props. I think you know who that is. That's Thomas Edison as a young man, and this is Dr. Viterbi as a young man. So, again, we begin with Edison. So, I'm sorry, I forgot USC. I start out with BE, before Edison. It turns out Edison was not the first person to record sound. It was recorded by a man in France. This is a sketch of him. And the thing was, it was recorded, but he couldn't play it back. He got the notion that sound involved wiggles of something. And so we have a stylus that was marking sound on a blackened drum, which made sense. But it's kind of hard to read from the scratches on the blackened drum. So he could record, but not play back. But he did pull it something very close to a phonograph. My French is poor, so I won't try to pronounce it. Edison came along, and an interesting thing that I found is he was born in Milan, but not Milan, Italy, Milan, Ohio. We'll get to that in a little bit. This again is Edison as a young man. And Edison, from the very beginning, was a promoter. And one of the things he did is he liked his autograph, and almost every product you buy of his has this autograph on it. This is a very famous autograph that some of you may have seen before. And in 1877, he created a playable recording, and he called it the phonograph. And so a little bit of what he did, initially, Edison etched sound waves on tinfoil, wrapped around a drum. And at least there were indentations now where you could read the indentations. And this is a picture of the initial one. Notice that it's a hand crank device. And the initial playback devices were hand cranked also. The spring came later. Later he replaced the tin foil with ground beeswax on a removable cylinder. And the advantage of that is you could record and play back, but then you could scrape off the recording and record again. The beeswax was thick enough. And so he could shave off the recording to make a new one. But the cylinders were very fragile. And so then he started trying to make something more stable. He added graphite to the beeswax to make permanent recordings. And this is what a cylinder looks like. And so let me just show you. Okay, later on you'll see how they were sold, but this is basically a cylinder. And they came like this. Okay. So he then he kept changing the material, and eventually the ones I have are made out of bakelite, and those are permanent recordings, and you can't scrape them off and make a new recording on it. Cylinders sold for about 35 cents each, so we're talking about 100 years ago. That's not cheap. 100 years ago, the players sold for as little as $7.50. And the small Edison that's over here, this is what I call the Sony Walkman of the day. All of these things, by the way, have covers with handles on them, and you can carry them. But as they get bigger and bigger, they need to be stronger and stronger to carry it. Here are some of them. And this one is very similar to what I have there. And then they became pieces of furniture in the house. Now, I'm going to play some of these for you in a couple minutes. But a technical, I feel I should give something technical. It's not electrical engineering, this part of it. He came to the conclusion it was better to make the recording where the needle went up and down, the vibration, rather than side to side. And he called it Hill and Dale recording. Now, he did something else which the modern phonographs don't have. The modern phonograph, the needle is both picking up the audio by vibrating, but it's also following the track. The track is, you know, this whatever that goes closer and closer in. Okay, he did something else, and that is each one of these has a worm gear. So on this one, right here, is the worm gear. I'll show you some pictures in a second. And the worm gear was in synchronism with the grooves on the recording. So it was pushing this across. And on the other hand, so the needle only had to sort of be very lightly on top of the whole thing to pick up the vibration. These are heavy things to be moved along. If the needle itself was propelling this, you would be wearing out records and needles constantly. So this is, and I can remember friends of mine had phonographs that had this, but this was a very high end of phonographs. And the original phonographs played 2-minute cylinders, and a modification was added to the players to play 4-minute cylinders.
So I think before I show you any pictures of things,
let me sort of give you a concept. So there's 3 different Edison cylinder phonographs here. This one. Okay. Before I play it, I think you've all heard of John Philip Sousa. And, you know, he has famous marches, and this is the most famous. But the interesting thing is, this is the Sousa band playing Sousa's music. I'll start it in the middle. Adjusted the speed. This one I have to guess. And then... I don't know if you know this song. I should tell you some things. If you want,
I mean, these are about 100 years old, and they work.
And there may be, you know, a part that I replaced, but basically it's the original. But to keep the spring with tension, you have to let it, the spring, you don't want to keep it tense
for a long period of time. So
I let them run out. I guess I have one of them running. Okay, so here is, if you see the worm gear, and let me just see where the worm gear is. Okay, this one, there's actually two different gears because he had 2 minute and 4 minute records. And so there were two different pitches on the gears, and one of them or the other one would be on here. This would push the needle across. Okay. Now, where's the amplification?
Well, let me just change this a second.
Okay. This is what's picking up the music. It's called the reproducer. We would call it a diaphragm. And this is what it looks like. Here's another one. Okay. It's fairly heavy, but again, it's counterweighted. And it's just sitting very lightly on the record, and it's going up and down. And the up and down movement is pushing on a diaphragm. And if I take the horns off, you can hardly hear it. But with the horns, you hear it nicely. And usually the bigger the horn, the better. This type of horn is, some of you who know a little bit about speakers, this is really like an exponential horn in the speaker that people used to have. And they all had special names. This one was called the witch's hat. And the nicest one is something called a morning glory, but I haven't gotten one yet. Okay, some pictures of Edison. If you notice here, he has a phonograph that's hand cranked rather than a motor. Here he is in his laboratory. He was very, very good at pushing himself and his product, etc. As a matter of fact, his way of pushing his products was by pushing himself. So he became the Wizard of Menlo Park, and if any of you this is more than you want to know about Edison, but it's a good book. And it tells about some things about him that he probably wouldn't want us to know. Here's what engineers looked like in those days, how they dressed. They're not young men. Here's the mechanics. I can show, if anyone's interested later, I'll open up one of them and you can look inside. And this is what is interesting. This is how the recording took place. So here's a whole band here, and here's just the one horn that's picking it up. And that one horn, by the way, is just, it's exactly this. This could be recording the information. The needle goes and digs into it. It's a slightly different stylus that's on here. But they used this one. Here, I don't know if you can see the horn. See the horn coming down here. And so, a little bit about advertising in those days. Here's a phonograph for $22. Now, I'm not going to dwell on this particular ad, although it's interesting. Here's a 2 minute record, and it's a song I guess people knew in those days, but I don't know it. At least this one is Tannhäuser. And so this is a classical piece, which is a 4 minute.
Do you have a date on that ad?
On this? I'm sure there's a date on it. This is all, I can tell you roughly, it had to be between 1905 and 1915. That's when the big, even before 1915, by 1915, something else was happening, which I'll get to. So we're talking about 100 years ago. Okay, I like this. If you see, this is looking for the band. And supposedly this boy is looking inside this device to try to find out where the band is that's playing the music. And this one, this is an ad not for buying a phonograph, but going to like a music hall to hear a phonograph.
And I love this because of what it says here. It says, the dream of the inventor realized, period. It will talk, sing, laugh, crow, whistle, repeat cornet solos, imitating the human voice, enunciating and pronouncing every word perfectly in every known language. Fantastic. Okay, and if you thought the notion of a free trial was moving, because you could get one of these at home, a party, and he had other things like a talking doll, which you pranked to make it talk. And this is the morning glory horn, that if any of you have one, I would love a donation to my project. And here's how, among other ways, phonograph records were sold, or I should call them cylinders. And somebody came around and, you know, like a milkman, I guess many of you here don't even know that that's the way milk used to be delivered. But in any event. And now, some mistakes he made. He believed that the main market for the phonograph was in the office and not in the home. And he and here's an ad that talks about how efficiently your office could be. Basically, what he was advertising is what I know as a dictaphone. Actually, he started a business called the Edifone business, but it became dictaphone. And but the notion that people would want these things in the living room, not something that he considered too seriously. And okay, and this is, I don't know why this one's here, but this is shows you that you don't have to have the horn sticking out there, but you could fold it around inside the device. And the some of the things I have, I'll show you later, have this folded horn in it. Okay, I guess the other thing I wanted to tell you about some errors he made, I'll wait a little bit, because what happened was this person, Emil Berliner, who was a German immigrant living in Washington, D.C., decided he had a better way of doing all this. And it basically was the flat record. And it was much easier to store and also to reproduce. And the reproduce part was an important thing because I've seen pictures of how they made recordings. And they would have one player and they would have pipes that would go to, say, five machines that were recorded and that were cutting the cylinders. And here, of course, what you could do is stamp them out. And interestingly, it's very much like VLSI, what he did. It was...
What was the actual date on that?
I'm sorry.
What was the actual date?
Berliner?
1898.
Oh. 1988. Sorry. Thank you. Thank you. Corrections will be gladly accepted. I didn't do that. Okay. Yeah, someone is. the master. Okay, so this is how he did it. It reminds me of stamping out VLSI. He took a flat disc made of zinc and coated it with beeswax again. He recorded on the beeswax. Now he was recording side to side, and now not up and down. And then he put it in acid. And where the recording took place, it was cut through the beeswax, he etched into the zinc. He then removed the wax, and he poured a some hard thing on top of it, and that became the stamper to stamp out the others. And so this is how you stamped out recordings. And he called it a gramophone. And again, initially it was powered by hand. Here's a hand one. And then here's a better view of it. And you can see it's cranked by hand. And later he put a spring in to control the speed. And the initial company was called Eldridge Johnson Company for a reason I'll skip, but then he called it the Victor Talking Machine Company,
And one of the things I read about this, there was a big patent fight, which he won. And I think Victor, the Victor Talking Machine Company, was he was the winner of the patent fight. So it's for Qualcomm to keep in mind. And he also trademarked his master's voice. And some of you have seen this. The dog has been called Nipper. And he called his machines, Victor the First, Victor the Second, very smart. And the machine with hidden horns were called Victrolas. And later, RCA Radio Corporation bought them, and it became RCA Victor. And so this is one with a horn. And this one has an interesting story that's about 30 hours old. I just bought this one on eBay. And I was hoping that I would have it to come, but buying on eBay is a whole other story. Okay, so Edison wasn't to be outdone, and he realized flat records were in. But he was a very stubborn person, and he insisted upon the Hill and Dale method of recording. So let me just show you his records. Now, I have several players for these, but they each weigh a ton. And so if I don't know how many of you can see, but it's a thick record. It's recording on both sides. And this was, and the players were called diamond disc players. And someone here told me he had one. And so here is a diamond disc phonograph. It had a diamond needle. It had a folded horn, and again, a worm gear propelled the needle across the records. That's why these records are 100 years old. They still play. And here's Edison with a flat record, and here's some furniture. Here's a beautiful piece of furniture. I don't know if it shows up there, but, I mean, these things sold for a lot of money in those days. And I can believe it would be the centerpiece of any living room, just like when TVs first came out. And so now I want to tell you some things about him. He was completely deaf, and he sometimes had to listen to things by biting on it and picking up the vibration through his teeth. And this, although I just have it as one item, this was really why he lost the market. He felt that people were going to buy these things to listen to the sound. And he said, gee, you know, for the quality, although he said the quality was great, people aren't going to tell the difference between Caruso and some pop singer that he could get for, you know, 1/100th of the price. And he wouldn't pay the stars. And boy, did he miss out. I mean, the whole Hollywood industry is based upon stars and not about the quality and Berliner, on the other hand, with the Victrolas, and then Columbia came in, and they understood the notion of stars. So, matter of fact, when you go back to Edison's records, you look at the names and you can't recognize anybody. Sousa, why was he able to record Sousa? Because Sousa was in the Marine Corps. And so probably he paid peanuts for the recordings of, you know, the Marine Band. And, okay, he also was not a college graduate, and he did not like the notion of what colleges, the so-called education that he said that people got to school. He thought it was more important just to have, let me not try to describe. So he gave a test to all his future employees, actually from some level up, and it was like 150 questions, like, why is cast iron called pig iron?
Does anybody know?
I don't have the foggiest notion to the answers to these questions.
Because when it smelts, it goes down, and for mangots, there's a pipe pig suckling along the sides of the saddle.
You have the potential of being high. Okay. This one I think a lot of us can get. Let's see if we can get to some. Who wrote Home Sweet Home? I'm sure others. Well, let me just show you. I mean, some of it. I like this one. What city in the United States leads in making laundry machines? That was a very important one. And what eight countries bound France? I'm sure a number of people here know. And so I skip down to the end. I like number 17. What are prunes and where do we get the most of them from? I don't know the answer to the second part, but I know what prunes are. And who is Paul Revere? Who is Salon? And he graded the test, and his grade was pass, or instead of fail, he gave an XYZ. He wanted to really fail people. It was much worse than that. Okay, now this, I don't want to go into. His big buddy was Henry Ford and Harvey Firestone. And they had things in common that probably not worthwhile going into in a lecture like this, but some of you know what it is. And in any event, Ford stayed with Edison. By that, I mean was a supporter of Edison to the very end. And by that, Edison's company didn't do that well. But Ford kept pouring money into it to keep them going, etc. And here's a picture of the two of them. So, that's Edison. I'm going to rapidly get to the Kirbys. And I think many of you know of the Berliner's records were 78s. So we have the 78s, then the 33s, and 45s. So I just want to play you a couple of 78s. These are all portable devices, and they're kind of neat. But let me just, this one does not need any amplification. I like this one. If you want to hear more of this, we can play it. This one's more interesting because this has something to do, well, first of all, notice all of these horns are continuous horns. And by that, I mean from the diaphragm out to the horn is solid. You look at this one, and the horn, starts at the needle and comes but ends before you get to the reflector. And this is like a dish for satellites. But more interesting is the record. Now, I don't know that we're going to be able to stay. I don't want to take too much time playing it. But I bought this in Australia. I bought it mainly because of this. But a record came along with it. And it's the recruiting record that the British played to get their colonies to support World War I. And if you know the story of what happened to the Australian army, this is particularly interesting. They got massacred, as you probably know. But so with that, I think you'll get the flavor of it from the very beginning, at least. This needs amplification. Sounds very British.
Thank you.
This is not an anti-war lecture, so I'll stop. But what's really interesting is the part of the recording where they talk about all the colonies, and they pretty much name them all. But when they get to Australia, and that's where I bought this, they refer to the Australian men as the men of the kangaroo, and which I guess it's not unflattering, but it's just an interesting thing. So in any event, we had 78 LPs, and this lasted a long time. I mean, this was from the 1920s through until basically the CD took over. And but remember, there was no ability to record here. And so an interesting thing is the first audio recorder was not magnetic tape, but wire recorder. And it recorded magnetically on steel wire. It was commercially available in the 30s in the U.S., but the U.S. used it during World War II. And some of you know the name Dave Slepian, who recently died. And in researching some things about him, we found out he was, and this was classified up until, believe it or not, and this time I'm saying it right, the 1990s, he was what was called a sonic deception officer. And they used the wire recorder to play through huge speakers to make sounds of tanks and other movements that to pretend that there was large divisions of the army there that weren't there. And this is what it looked like. That's a reel of wire. It gets tangled very easily. We have a couple of them. And so, and then the open reel audio recorder, I'm sure all of you have seen. And then a succession of tape recorders followed, and many different varieties were introduced for both commercial and consumer use. And I guess before I go to the next thing, I mean, one thing which never took off as a commercial product was what's called a DAT, and it's a tape that looks like this. You could record and play back. Now this is a pre-recorded one, so you could play back on it. And let's see if it'll play. Very high quality, much higher quality than CD. And this was used for recording audio. Is that enough? No, that may be as loud as I can make it. Okay, this is the door playing. In a good audio setting, this is fantastic. Then came the ever-popular cassette recorder. And, I mean, this was very, very popular for a long time. I still have a car that has a cassette recorder in it, cassette playback, I should say. So let's see if I can play this for you. Okay, we're rapidly getting to today, so the interesting thing with digital is initially the artists didn't believe in digital. They were, you know, they were sold this bill of goods that it distorts their signal, that's their voice or music, etc. And so the only way originally they were used was backup on analog recording. And then when digital came into play, these backup things became very valuable. And so we get to the CD, and you know, the music is recorded on a spiral track starting at the center. This is optical. I don't know if this is of interest to you. It is to me that the spiral is about 3.5 miles long, and they made it particularly so that they could play Beethoven's Ninth. That was, they made it just long enough to play Beethoven's Ninth. And I can play you a CD. I don't know, yeah, well, okay. Let's see if I have, I can do this for you. Okay. Here's the CD, and what happens is that there's a very strong error correction code on here with a USC connection, of course. It's a Reed-Solomon code. And what I've done is I've intentionally ruined this. I can erase it. And I put a very narrow line here, which causes a few hundred errors. And then I put a thick line that causes many more. And I'm sure you'll believe me, I could play it for you, but what happens is if we play, and it starts from the inner track, if we play the first few pieces, it'll play through those and you won't hear any problems. But if you get to the end where the thick line is, then it just goes bonkers. So I think I'll skip that part of it and get to the what we've been waiting for. So, along came Viterbi. So, Andrea Viterbi was born in Bergamo, Italy, and Bergamo is very close to Milan, but not Milan, Ohio. On March 9th, 1935, so his birthday's coming up, and in 1967 he published the Viterbi algorithm, and which I'm going to skip over. And he called it an asymptotically optimal decoding algorithm. And here's a young Viterbi. So I wanted to give you some little background of, you know, how did this all come about? So before 67, he worked on a number of other research areas. For example, he contemplated a new and improved bicycle. So, and you can thank Alan for the pictures. And then the question is, you know, how do you come up with an algorithm like this? It takes a little bit. So before the idea hit, this is what Andy looked like. And then I think this is a picture when he first got the notion. And so then he had to, you know, really work on the idea. He cooked up the idea. And eureka, here he has the algorithm. Anything that you don't like, Andy, we can eliminate from the final version. Okay. And so, and Andrew could not have done it alone, and of course that's Myrna and Andrew. They got married in 58, and if you can do your calculation right, this is a very important year. And do I have time for a joke? Should I tell the 50th anniversary joke? go ahead. Okay. The source is Ernest. This is a fellow whose 50th anniversary is coming up, and he was asked, you know, how did you make this work all this time? He said, well, you know, he treated his wife right. He said for their 20th anniversary, he took his wife to Italy. And they had a wonderful time. This is such a great place. And that seemed to be the end of the story. So they said, well, what are you going to do for the 50th? He said, well, I'm going back to Italy and I'm going to pick her up. So, now you have to excuse a little technical stuff. The Viterbi algorithm, you know, it's been used in communication systems from deep space probes to cellular telephones, and, you know, you've heard this from a number of previous speakers, so I'm going to skip over that and talk about how it impacted magnetic recording. So, this is an iPod, and this is, you know, the high-capacity iPods now use disk drives. The low-capacity ones use flash memory, but the high-capacity ones use disk drives. And each disk drive uses the Viterbi algorithm. So, to give you an idea, you can buy an iPod now with 160 gigs of memory, which will store 40,000 songs or 200 hours of video, or if you want a combination of those expressed in a different way, 400 hours of music and 7 hours of video. It retails for approximately $350, and this was all made possible by shrinking the disk drives and making them super cheap. So to give you an idea of a little bit of what has happened in disk drives, this is a factory floor of making hard disk drives, IBM hard disk drives, in 1975. And you can see the man there. And, you know, these were like washing machines. And the total capacity of that factory floor was 20 gigabytes. And the selling price would have been $4 million. That's because they didn't use the Viterbi algorithm. So what we usually have, I mean, almost any talk you go to at our center has this graph. This is areal density in megabits per square inch. And this is the initial device. I'll show you a little bit more about it. If you notice, it had this slow growth and then this, and you might guess why. This is before Viterbi, and this is after Viterbi. Now, there may have been some other things, like two guys won the Nobel Prize this year for something else that took place there. But in any event, so this is just probably more detail than what you want. This is the original drive. This was 1956. A 5 megabyte device. It probably was bigger than I am and as big as this. The areal density was 2 kilobits per square inch. This is the 160 gigabyte drive, 130 gigabits per square inch. Cost per megabyte, $10,000. Now it's less than this, the 10% per megabyte. So, where does the Viterbi algorithm come in? In the sense, magnetic recording is a little boring. There's none of the fancy modulation stuff that we use in communications is useful because you can only use plain baseband plus one minus one signaling. And each transition in the magnetization results in an output pulse, and I'm just going to show you all this. So here's an example. Suppose you want to record minus one plus one minus one. You would record it on the medium as magnetized in this direction, then this direction. Or nowadays it's up and down, but it doesn't matter. And the readback signal, each one of these transitions gives you a pulse. When you put the two together, you get the superposition of pulses. And that's fine as long as these transitions aren't close to each other. But how do you get these high densities, putting them closer together? So before Viterbi, transitions in magnetization were detected by finding the peaks of the readback signal. And so here's a readback signal, and it's so fat that it would interfere with others. And so what they did is put it through something called an equalizer, and it made it into an arrow pulse. I mean, this is freshman Fourier transform, so we know how to do that. But the pulse-limiting equalizer accentuates high-frequency noise. It's essentially a high-pass filter, and this is a major problem. And so Viterbi came riding to the rescue. And here he is. And so what Viterbi did, of course, was it used a system where it uses the Viterbi algorithm. IBM introduced it and was called PRML, or Partial Response Maximum Likelihood, and there was no V in the acronym because Viterbi did not work for IBM. I'm sure they would have called it Partial Response Viterbi Detection, but they didn't want to do that. And it's just the number, which about a half billion PRML disk drives containing the Viterbi algorithm are sold each year. So it's a major, major impact. Okay, I think I'm going to skip the details of that and this. So, just about right timing. Summary. Thomas Edison invented photographs. That's all I'm going to say about him. Okay, Andrew Viterbi invented the Viterbi algorithm, but I'll say more. Andrew's contributions to engineering and science have been recognized in a number of ways. Honorary degrees from University of Waterloo, University of Rome, Tor Vergata, Technion, Notre Dame, University of Rome, Sapienza, USC. And I don't have the picture of the USC one. I'm sure there's many pictures of that around the campus here, but here's the Technion awarding Andy the honorary degree. He is a knight, and I don't know the correct way of saying it in Italian, so I won't say it, but I guess Sir Andrew sounds good. But Erna and Andrew Viterbi's contributions to society go far beyond the subject matter of the talk. Not two of the least are the Viterbi family. And, oops, I'm sorry. How did that happen? The USC Viterbi School of Engineering, which I'm sure you know all about. So, in any event, grazie infinite, Erna and Andrew.
Just a technical question. I was watching an old movie from the 40s called Double Indemnity, and there was a scene where that detective recorded on something like a dicta belt. But you didn't mention that in your
okay.
How that
in a longer version of the talk, I have pictures of it. It's again, you're right. It's actually a wide belt, and it's again. It started out with the Ediphone, and then it became Dictaphone, and this.
What's the material?
I don't know.
It's flexible.
I don't know the material. All I know is the picture I have. It's a very bright color, so I don't know whether that was the color was just added. I don't know the material.
Questions. Again, what was the name of that device that was developed in CD Equality?
Oh, this is a DAT. And I can just tell you a little bit more about it. Okay, the technology is very similar to the VCR tape, only it's a very small tape. And so what I mean by that, there's a rotating head. And one of the things with magnetic recording, to get high frequencies, the speed that the tape passes by the head has to be very high. So one way of doing it is to have the tape go a mile a minute past a stationary head. Another way of doing it is to put the head on a rotating cylinder and then write stripes across it. That's what this is. And this is essentially the same quality as CD, but is much better quality than, say, your iPod. I forgot to play the iPod, but I'm sure you people know about iPods. Yes?
So, can you say something about how far away we are from the maximum
distance? Okay. You know the curve that I showed where I label? Okay. In the 25 years I've been at the center, we've always had that curve, and we've had a maximum. Every time we get close to the maximum, we go right through it. So the answer is very hard. Let me just mention a difference. We're used to communications where, for the most part, particularly wireless, we have no control over the media. The media is the ether or whatever you want to call it.
Here, they keep changing the materials on us. So it's very, very hard to talk about what the ultimate maximum is. You can talk about with the current material. So matter of fact, the big thing now is to they feel that for hard disks, that they're going to have to go to an entirely different type of system. And one of these systems is called Pattern Media, and we're working a lot on it at the center. But looks like we can keep going. And when I joined the center 25 years ago, my friends, I won't say Andy was in that group, he was in the group of friends, but my friends at Bell Labs told me, boy, you've done a stupid thing. Magnetic recording is dead. It's optics. Okay, and of course that didn't happen.
So. I may make one more comment. You alluded to my singing or non-singing. The star system really made the record business, and the big star for the Deutsche Grammophon was Caruso. He was the first singer to sing to sell a million records, and people wanted to hear Caruso and everything.
Right. When people come to my house, I have probably a couple of hundred cylinders, and they say, "Play the Caruso."
Going back to the point about the stars, so would you say that a little statute about stars would make it with the view of the engineer?
I wouldn't blame all engineers in that way, but it's certainly, I mean, he was so involved in the technical aspects of it that he probably, you know, convinced himself that, you know, if the power spectrum was right and if the noise level was down. Although the other aspect of Edison that I didn't mention, he wasn't a scientist. He was really, once he had enough money and he had a problem, he just tried every solution. He wasn't interested in sort of understanding the basic phenomena involved. That's at least my view in reading this.
Some years ago, I read a long biography of George Eastman, who also knew Edison fairly well, and in fact, they were partners in the motion picture industry. Edison had invented the motion picture camera, and Edison wanted to have a complete monopoly on the making of motion pictures. Eastman thought privately that Edison was very stupid. Eastman's idea was sell as much film as possible. The more people who were making movies, the better. And he thought Edison should have had the same idea about his cameras, rather than trying to control the product and the content. And of course, Edison lost out. It wasn't possible to monopolize the making of motion pictures.
Right. With the device that he has, I mentioned the diamond disc player for playing these. It would have been very easy for him, and others did it, to make a player that played both these and the 78s. It would do it. Someone else did it, and you can buy those devices, but they're not Edison-made devices. Now, he was very stubborn. He also had some very strong views about Wall Street, that didn't like Wall Street. And when you read the book, he didn't. Well, he died a rich man, but not the rich man that he could have been. Yes?
Yeah, in the late 70s, everybody was saying that disk drives are going to die out, we're all going to be using magnetic bubble memory. Whatever happened to that technology?
Die out. Now, that was one out of several things that never made it commercially. Bell Labs was working on that, and others were working on it. Another thing was magneto-optics. There was a computer made by NextWave. NextWave is enough. That's the NextWave. By, what was it? It was called
the next computer, I guess.
The next computer
was a black box.
Steve Jobs.
And it had a magneto optic drive, and it was too slow, and among other things.
Any other questions or comments? Okay, let's thank our speaker once again. Special gifts here. We have for you our honorary Trojan kit here. And there are three really important items in here. Okay, the first one, of course, is the Turvey School of Engineering pin.
Okay. You can enter your suit. I'll put it right on.
Just like that.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
And then we have a Ningxia special T-shirt. These are really quite well done.
Absolutely. Well, I'll show you all. Okay. Thank you so much.
But then we have something very, very special. It's a audio data storage device disguised as a pen. And this I think is just unbelievable. So here's a pen. It's a UNC Trojan pin. So watch what happens when you push the button. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay.